WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The U.S. is in a state of high alert because of the danger of a terrorist attack during this holiday period. After the attacks of September 11th, U.S.-led forces bombed Afghanistan and drove out the Taliban regime, which had harbored leaders of al-Qaeda. Now the U.S. is helping Afghanistan rebuild and move toward democracy. Yesterday, the military announced that the American forces in Afghanistan will be expanded to help increase security surrounding reconstruction projects. Aloya Jirga, or Grand Council, is now meeting in Kabul to draft a constitution. My guest, John Sifton, is the Afghanistan researcher for the group Human Rights Watch. He's gone there every few months since September 11th and just returned from a three-week visit. He monitored the election of delegates to the Loya Jirga. After the Loya Jirga convened over a week ago, he met with delegates and talked with observers. President Hamid Karzai has said he hopes the Loya Jirga will complete its business by the end of the year. I spoke with John Sifton this morning. I asked if he thinks that Afghanistan, like Iraq, is seen as a showplace where others can judge what the United States can do to help a country move toward democracy after the U.S. has forced the leadership out of power.
The United States ousted the Taliban, but essentially their accomplishments ended there. I know that sounds pretty amazing, but essentially that's true. What happened was the Taliban collapsed. What happened next? The allies of the United States, the Mujahideen leaders who were fighting against the Taliban, who fought with the U.S. against them, took over the country. Then what happened? Not much. Not much. Some projects to rebuild the country started in a few places. But for most part, the entire country has plodded along since then. Very little progress on reconstruction, very little progress on good governance, you know, making the ministries work better, starting to have a real civil service. Very little progress on building up democratic institutions, civic society groups, political party laws and groups like that. There's been a little sort of mini renaissance in Kabul. There are all these newspapers and NGOs, non-governmental organizations, aid organizations. But outside of Kabul, there's very little progress. You see, I mean, I don't want to be completely disingenuous. I don't want to be completely cynical here, but there are a few places where things have happened. I agree. Herat, the city in the west, and Kabul, the city in the east, have seen reconstruction privately. But for the most part, if you scratch the surface, you'll see that those reconstruction projects are underwritten by factional leaders, by warlords, essentially. This isn't really a legitimate reconstruction. It's a sort of power elite that's underpaying for some of this reconstruction. And then outside of those cities, in the rural areas, nothing. Absolutely nothing. There's one single accomplishment, which is the road from Kabul to Kandahar has been built. And that took way too long. But other than that, you know, what's happened? A few things there, a few things there, a well, an irrigation system. But where's the hydroelectric dams that they promised? Where's the roads connecting all the major cities? It's not as though these things haven't been accomplished. They haven't even been started.
And who was blamed for that?
When the Taliban fell, local governance was put into the hands of military factional leaders. Now, while there was reason to think that some of these people could actually provide security in the sense of stopping fighting, stopping the Taliban from shelling certain cities, the simple law and order, the sense in which people would be free from being looted, being robbed by gunmen, things like that, these people are not the right men for the job. The military factions in Afghanistan are themselves thieves. They loot. They extort money. And so to expect them to sort of bring security to ordinary Afghans outside of the city was, in some sense, a ludicrous idea. But yet that's what the United States did.
Is that considered to be payback for the warlords' military assistance during the ousting of the Taliban?
To a degree, I think it is a sense of these guys helped us with the Taliban. So we're going to let them have the keys to the kingdom. And certainly that was what – that was the sentiment that I heard. I testified before a House of Representatives International Relations Committee on this subject, and that was a message I was yelled at by a certain congressman about this issue. And, you know, he said, these guys, you call them warlords, but you know, these guys were with us. They fought against the Taliban. We should be thanking them, you know, so on and so forth. So there is a sense of what you said, you know, that these guys helped us, and so they're given a free check. But I think what it also is just a sort of mistake that the Department of Defense men, the people on the ground, the men and women of the U.S. military, got down there, and they sort of figured these guys were better guys than they are. And that mistake, I think, comes out of a lack of understanding of Afghanistan's recent past. These guys didn't just appear. They have a history. They fought against the Soviets. And when the Soviet regime collapsed 10 years ago, they took over Afghanistan. And Afghanistan 10 years ago, many people don't remember this because there were other things going on at the time. The Soviet Union was collapsing. There were the problems in the Balkans. But 10 years ago, Afghanistan was a mess. There was a civil war raging in Kabul's streets. It wasn't an extraordinary thing to see troops firing in civilian areas from mountains outside of Kabul, straight into civilian areas. It wasn't uncommon for there to be kidnapping, widespread looting in the streets. People used to talk about bodies lying in the streets, even dogs dragging body parts around. I mean, it was a horrific scene of inhumanity. And who was responsible? These Mujahideen leaders who are now in power.
My understanding is this is part of the reason why the Taliban were welcomed in some quarters when they took over, because at least there was law and order.
There was a degree of relief when the Taliban first took over because there was a thought that they would bring stability, at least to Kabul City, which had been racked by violence. That optimism was quickly consumed by fear because of the Taliban's strict and capricious and cruel interpretations of Islamic law. But they did bring security in a limited sense of the word. They brought peace in the sense that there was no longer groups fighting it out in the streets, kidnapping women and children, and raping daughters and wives. But you know, there was a flip side to that, and it was a different type of evil.
John Sifton is my guest, and he's the Human Rights Watch's Afghanistan researcher. He just returned from Afghanistan. What was your mission in Afghanistan?
We went to monitor and observe some of the last elections to the Constitutional Convention, which started a Sunday before last. There were elections in all the regional centers to elect delegates to go to the convention and debate a draft of the Constitution. Unfortunately, the entire process from the beginning to the end was dominated by factional leaders, and there was intimidation, vote buying, death threats riddled throughout the whole process. And we saw that even in Kabul City itself, where there are peacekeepers and an increased number of international monitors. I saw myself intimidation underway. The head of the Kabul Intelligence Secretariat was there. The head of all of Afghanistan intelligence was at the election. There were several commanders there. The entire process was conducted within an atmosphere of intimidation and fear. And so a lot of the delegates who were elected were just factional proxies. And the few courageous souls who did sort of step up to the plate and fight were put under enormous pressure and are now outnumbered at the convention.
Now, you've said that the elections to the Loya Jirga were manipulated through fear and intimidation, and that a lot of these former warlords have either been elected or have had their proxies elected to the Loya Jirga. Actually, the warlords aren't, the former so-called warlords aren't allowed to be in this Loya Jirga. Is that correct?
It's true that there is a prohibition against people who are currently military commanders in Afghanistan's defense ministry, but the rule is wildly flouted by commanders, especially outside of Kabul. Some people were sidelined, but even the infamous leader Rashid Dostum in the north, was elected. He was disqualified by the Constitutional Commission, but subsequently President Hamid Karzai, appointed him to the convention, to the disappointment of many delegates. So there was a sense that, yeah, everybody was getting in. And this is the same as last year's Loya Jirga. There's really a sense that anybody who holds a powerful stake in Afghanistan's militarily dominant culture can get a spot at the Loya Jirga. You might have some trouble along the way, but ultimately you'll get in.
Why do you think Hamid Karzai appointed Dostum if Dostum is a warlord, a former warlord who's not even supposed to be in the Loya Jirga?
A few days before the Loya Jirga started, Lise Doucette of the BBC, competent reporter, BBC strong horse, you know, old school reporter, had an interview with Hamid Karzai, and she asked him that question. And he said he was elected. It's good for the country. Do you prefer war? Now, those are three different responses. The first is he was elected. Okay, well, he was also disqualified by the Constitutional Commission because of his military post. So that's kind of a strange response. Second thing he said, it's good for the country. And do you prefer fighting? You know, do you prefer war? He's on stronger ground there. There are political necessities here. And I understand that President Karzai and the U.S. can't just completely sideline these people. But what we've seen is that both President Karzai and the U.S. administration have made very few efforts just to marginalize these people, to tell them, hey, we'll deal with you. You know, we have to deal with you. We can't just ignore you. But you can't have everything. You know, there has to be legitimate governance. What we've seen is a sort of failure to enforce that idea. And so President Karzai, in a way, I feel sympathy for him. He's in an extremely, extremely difficult situation. But he hasn't pushed hard enough against these people to say, I'm sorry, you can't have the keys to the kingdom. You guys can't rule this country. You helped defeat the Soviets. Well, in Dostum's case, he was with the Soviets until the end. But, you know, the Mujahideen leaders, he could say to them, you helped defeat the Soviets. You helped defeat the Taliban with U.S. support. But, you know, you can't have it all. But that's just not something he's saying.
What are some of the directions the military leaders, the former warlords, are likely to head in at the Loya Jirga? What are some of the things they would like to see in the Constitution?
Well, actually, interestingly, most of this stuff doesn't really matter in the end because, as it turns out, the U.S. and Karzai have recognized that these guys run the show. The concern of the U.S. right now is to get the Loya Jirga to approve a draft of the Constitution, which has already been promulgated, which gives President Karzai very strong presidential powers. It looks like that draft will be accepted. And the reason it looks like that's going to happen is that it seems that Karzai and the U.S. have made deals with most of the factional leaders to get them to use their bloc voting power, the proxies they control, to approve it. So the majority of the delegates, there are 500 or so delegates, are proxies and allies of the factional leaders. But it looks like they're on board. So that issue about the presidency is decided. The other issues about human rights, about little sort of technical issues, should there be habeas corpus, a right, you know, to the defendant to be brought before a court, things like this, may not get discussed in the end because the whole discussion has been consumed and dominated by this issue of the presidency, strong presidential powers.
If President Karzai has been making deals with some of the factional leaders in return for them voting for a strong presidency, what kind of relationship is he likely to have with them in the future? And, I mean, if he really is a strong president, can't he use that strength to limit their power?
Well, our worry is that he'll emerge with a strong presidency on paper. And meanwhile, these guys who made deals will become all the stronger. There's a sense that he still holds the money. Karzai has the international money at his disposal. But he can't quite bring these guys under control. There's very little sense that the Constitution's going to allow him to do that, the new constitution. He's still going to face all the same problems. How do you enforce an order? These guys have their own military weapons. They have their own SUVs. They even have their own tanks in some places. How do you enforce the order? It's very difficult. So he's made deals with them to give them even more power than they already have. There's very little sense his job is going to be any easier in coming months and years.
My guest is John Sifton, the Afghanistan researcher for the group Human Rights Watch. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is John Sifton, the Afghanistan researcher for the group Human Rights Watch. He just returned from Afghanistan, where the Loya Jirga, or Grand Council, is convening to write a new constitution. What is the debate like about whether the constitution should be based on Islamic law?
The discussions haven't been dominated by questions about Islamic law versus human rights and things like that. They've been dominated by the question of whether the system of government should be a presidential one or a parliamentary one. The discussions about Sharia and human rights, which could have taken place, which aren't really taking place, are about things like should the Supreme Court have the power to interpret legislation to see whether it is contrary to Islamic law? Should courts have the power to discharge or overturn legislation? What should the qualifications be for the Supreme Court? Should people have religious training or not? And what would that mean? Personally, I don't think that the Constitution will settle a lot of the issues about Islamic law and human rights. Because at the end of the day, the emphasis on these questions and the answers to these questions will be in the hands of judges appointed to Afghanistan's judiciary, not tomorrow, but 10 years from now. So the weight really is on those judges. We can draft the language and make it perfect or imperfect or whatever today, but essentially, whatever we draft, the interpretation will ultimately be laid down 10 years from now. And the real emphasis here should be placed on making sure that that court, Supreme Court of Afghanistan, isn't dominated by fundamentalists, Islamic scholars whose interpretation of Islam is not in accordance with the majority of Afghans. And that's what we're concerned about here, right, is democracy, to make sure that the people who are interpreting these laws have a vision of Islam and a vision of human rights which is similar to the Afghan people's. And that's what we should be worried about. The question of the Constitution itself, though, may not be where these issues will be resolved.
Has there been much debate yet about women's rights and what the Constitution will have to say about that?
There has. A women's group put together a draft of the Constitution that they presented before the Constitutional Convention started. There are a lot of delegates to the convention. 100 out of 500 are women. And a lot of those women have been pretty vocal about women's rights. But the sense right now is that the draft as presented by President Karzai will be adopted. And it doesn't really contain very special protections for women's rights. It's not, you know, against women's rights, but it's certainly not a sort of proactive document. There has been discussion of whether the Constitution needs stronger protections, but those discussions don't seem to have gotten very far. The sights have been placed pretty low since the Taliban fell. Everything is, you know, in comparison to the Taliban, life is better. But as many women in Kabul will tell you, if you compare life to the Taliban, anything is better.
Well, how have things changed for women in Afghanistan, in the cities and in the country? Can they walk around without burqas? Can they walk around without male escort? Are girls going to school?
Millions of girls have gone back to school, but the majority of school-age girls are still out of school, partly because of security concerns. Families are afraid to send their girls to school because of the sense that they might be sexually assaulted or even kidnapped on the way to school, especially outside of major cities. At the same time, in the cities, there is still a lot of fear. There's no enforcement making women wear the burqa, but yet you walk around most areas, women still do wear the burqa. there hasn't been any scientific polling or studying, but if you go around and ask a lot of women why they're still wearing the burqa, they talk about the sense of instability. They don't know whether Karzai's government may fall in a year. And there'll be some extremely conservative new government that may create problems. There's also a sense that there continues to be gunmen, police, intelligence, army guys who go around and still harass women if they're not wearing a burqa. They may not arrest them or beat them like the Taliban did, but there's a sense that you can run into trouble if you don't wear a burqa.
John Sifton is the Afghanistan researcher for the group Human Rights Watch. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with John Sifton, the Afghanistan researcher for the group Human Rights Watch. He's visited Afghanistan every few months since September 11th. He just returned from a three-week trip to Afghanistan, where the Loya Jirga, or Grand Council, is currently meeting to draft a new constitution. What is your popularity in Afghanistan as a human rights worker? Who sees you as the good guy and who sees you as the bad guy?
Well, unfortunately, it's become clear that the warlord factions in Afghanistan are aware of our presence, and they are worried. They're keeping an eye on what we're doing. They're especially concerned about the past because they know that we've been looking at some of the things that have been going on 10 years ago. You know, we've just studied Human Rights Watch was working on Afghanistan in the 1980s, documenting abuses by the Soviets. We documented abuses by the Taliban. This is something we do, but they also know that there's this other period, this period between 1992 and 1996, when the Mujahideen themselves were in control and they committed atrocities. And I think that they're very worried that we may bring those issues up as well. There is an Afghan Human Rights Commission, which is looking at these issues, but is extremely timid about pushing them, and rightly so. If you were to hold a press conference releasing some report about Mujahideen atrocities 10 years ago, your life would be in danger. My life would be in danger. But especially Afghans.
Because so many of those people are powerful again.
Yeah. People like Rasul Sayaf, people like Defense Minister Fahim, people like the Education Minister Kanuni, these people have passed, and they know that they could be called into account for them. And so they're rightly afraid. There are also abuses going on now. A lot of the factional leaders in Kabul are implicated in massive land seizure abuses. Hundreds of homes have been seized by local commanders or people acting with the protection of local commanders in Kabul. The homes are subsequently rented or given away to supporters. This is a huge scandal that's happening right in Kabul city itself. But if you talk about these things, if you report on them, you can be in danger.
The United States has announced it will be sending more troops to Afghanistan to increase security in the hopes that it will protect workers who are rebuilding Afghanistan. They also want to protect aid workers. Do you think that will be helpful to your efforts and the efforts of other aid and human rights groups?
Yeah, yesterday's announcement by the U.S. military about expanding their forces, especially in the south, is a welcome step in the right direction. But it's not enough. There needs to be more effort placed on sidelining the military factional leaders and bringing in more legitimate representation at the governmental level, the local governmental level. And that's what we're not seeing.
Now, there's been Taliban insurgencies in parts of Afghanistan. Have you yourself seen evidence of the Taliban trying to, you know, get back power in Afghanistan?
It's interesting what they're up to. There's a lot of psychological warfare, pamphlets, warnings delivered to people, schools being set fire in the night. It's not a sense that the Taliban could sort of take over, you know, run into a town and take over the governmental offices and all that stuff. I think that's beyond their power. But they still have the power to intimidate and to keep people from cooperating with the Western agencies and with the Karzai government. And that's really their worst effect.
I remember when you joined us not long after September 11th, and you had been in Afghanistan, you were describing what it was like before September 11th to see these trucks of, like, these Toyota pickup trucks filled with, you know, local Taliban leaders patrolling the streets to make sure that men were wearing beards and women were wearing, you know, the burqa. Do you see anything like that going on now?
What there is intimidation of people who are cooperating with the West. So let's say you're a school teacher in the South in, say, Zawal province, and you teach girls mathematics, Dari, science, and you're on your way to school. Suddenly somebody comes up to you and says, stop teaching or we'll come for you in the night, or stop teaching or your family will be in danger. That's what we're seeing behind the scenes, subtle threats, messages delivered at night, nailed to your door saying, don't cooperate with the Western imperialist forces, things like that. Another thing we've seen is pamphlets with pictures of the U.S. forces searching homes, searching women, you know, patting them down, things like that. Extremely divisive images that, you know, might get people to say, oh, the Western people are imperialist, they're against our culture, things like that. Women's education is a big issue that the Taliban has pushed on, and I think that's one of their biggest focus. They're not so interested at this moment making sure people are wearing burqas and growing their beards.
So what are they doing to try to prevent girls from going to school?
They've set fire to many schools in the South. In the middle of the night, a school will burst into flames, even get hit with a rocket sometimes. Another thing that happens is that teachers get threatened, told not to show up, or parents get threatened not to send their daughters to school. But interestingly, in a majority of cases, people say they don't send their daughters or sisters to school because they're afraid of local forces creating problems for them, security problems, you know, harassing their daughters or even kidnapping them. So it's definitely not just the Taliban that's having an effect on women's education. It's also the insecurity.
One of the questions that Iraq and Afghanistan poses is, how do you create a democracy in a country that has not been a democracy? Do you feel like you're learning any lessons about what to or what not to do?
The lesson of Afghanistan is that without providing a semblance of stability before you seek to create a governmental system and a democratic governmental institution, you can face a lot of problems. You must address the basic law and order on the streets before you can expect people to move into a political process which is democratic. Many political opponents, party organizers, journalists don't even feel safe enough to criticize the United States, let alone Afghanistan's warlords. So in what sense could you have democratic elections that are free and fair in a situation like that in which there's so much intimidation? The lesson is, provide security, provide semblance of stability before you move forward. And that's what we haven't done in Afghanistan and what we're not doing in Iraq. Iraq is a more difficult case, of course, but it's definitely something which could have been addressed in Afghanistan and hasn't.
In trying to create stability, is there the possibility of creating something that leans in the direction of becoming a police state?
There's always a concern that in the short term, to create stability, you really need to crack down on the spoilers. It's true. I'm not going to deny it. Some of these people, these warlords who are creating instability, may need a dose of vitamin B52, as some of the Afghans call it. I don't pretend that there isn't an ugly side to enforcing stability, and I know that there are a lot of hard choices out there, but these are the hard choices which have to be made. When a warlord like Ismail Khan in the West or General Dostum in the North refuses to bring his troops under control, there have to be consequences. And there are no consequences for these men when they flout Karzai and they flout human rights standards.
Do you feel like you make a difference?
The work we have done has led the U.S. to realize it has a problem, that its strategy has been flawed. And this is the single thing that, you know, we feel like we actually had an impact on. But, you know, human rights reporting is an interesting line of work because essentially you give recommendations which are almost never followed. That's not where our success is. Our success is in bringing facts to the attention of people who don't know about them. It's like the tree falling in the forest. Nobody knows that there was a, you know, climate of fear outside of Kabul, extortion, kidnapping, local commanders, you know, raping young women and boys. We brought it to the world's attention, and so there was a new sort of sense of reality about the situation in Afghanistan. That's our benefit. But other than that, it's difficult to see how our recommendations are regularly followed. I mean, they just aren't.
But John, thank you for coming, and I hope you're feeling better soon.
Thanks for having me.
John Sifton is the Afghanistan researcher for the group Human Rights Watch. Tobias Wolff is best known for his 1989 memoir, This Boy's Life, which was adapted into a film. Wolff's memoir was something of a companion piece to his brother Jeffrey's memoir, The Duke of Deception, a portrait of their father, a con man who fooled even his own children into believing he was from an aristocratic background. When Jeffrey and Tobias were children, their parents split up. Jeffrey lived with his father, Tobias with his mother. While Jeffrey was learning genteel manners, how to shoot and handle a boat, Tobias and his mother were virtually broke. This Boy's Life was about those early years. Now Wolff has written his first novel, Old School. It's about a boy who is attending an elite boarding school on a scholarship and desperately wants to be a writer. Old School is about class conflicts and what this boy goes through to find his voice and his identity. Tobias Wolff teaches at Stanford University. In the school that your novel is set in, there's a tradition in which one boy is given a private audience with each visiting writer. And we're talking about visiting luminaries. It's Robert Frost, Ayn Rand, Ernest Hemingway. Was there a tradition like that in your school?
Yes, there was. Indeed, I saw Robert Frost at my school. And I'm actually a couple of years younger than my narrator, so I was sitting in the back and I didn't get a chance to hear anything he said. And that's the great thing about writing a novel is that you can go back and make those moments that were not satisfactory in life just as perfect as you want to make them. And so, and obviously in the novel, I get to not only have him speak right in my ear, but even in a sense to have a conversation with him in the novel, which is something that I felt was long overdue.
One of the writers scheduled to visit is Ernest Hemingway, and your main character says, "I already admired Hemingway above all other writers, but the truth was that I'd been drawn to him mostly by his life, that is, by the legend of his life, and by a set of ideas about his work that spilled over from the legend." What about you? What was the influence of Hemingway on you?
Oh, that's a pretty clear statement of how Hemingway affected me as a young as a boy. I remember, they used to remember those big pictures that they used to have at the back of Life magazine, big black and white, took up a whole page. And I remember when I was about 14 or so, seeing a picture of Ernest Hemingway leaving Madison Square Garden with Marlene Dietrich on his arm after a prize fight. And I remember thinking, you know, this is a great reason to be a writer. There was very much the sense of an extraordinary life to be lived that belonged to the writer. And he exemplified this. And of course, what one could never know at my age is that these were the things he was doing when he wasn't writing. That he was a man of tremendous industry who worked every day, even you know, when his back was killing him, and he even stood up to write. As he himself once said, he came to his work like a priest to the altar, and he had that kind of mission about it. But I have to say that as a boy, it was the glamour, the travel, the hunting, the fishing, what one imagined of his beautiful women, that kind of thing. The thrill-seeking, really, seemed so deeply connected to his writing that when I was a boy, I couldn't separate it, and it drew me in, there's no question. As I grew older, of course, I began to see the beauty and the art of his writing, and this eventually, of course, displaced any notions I had of his life, and it's the work that that endures in my love, that especially that those early stories, those beautiful, tender stories, and the early novels I particularly love as well. But he never really lost his touch.
Would you read some of the advice that you have Hemingway giving in your novel?
Sure. This is some advice that Hemingway is giving the narrator of the novel. Don't talk about your writing. If you talk about your writing, you will touch something you shouldn't touch, and it will fall apart, and you will have nothing. Get up at first light and work like hell. Let your wife sleep in. It'll pay off later. Watch your blood pressure. Read. Read James Joyce and Bill Faulkner and Isaac Dinesen, that beautiful writer. Read Scott Fitzgerald. Hold on to your friends. Work like hell and make enough money to go someplace else, some other country where the damn feds can't get at you. Did I say keep your friends? Keep your friends. Hold on to your friends. Don't lose your friends. I don't know. I guess that's it. That's the sermon for today.
How did you write this advice from Hemingway?
Great question. You know, this was the greatest fun I had in writing this book, was impersonating these writers. I mean, literally becoming the person that I imagined them to be. And I did this by immersing myself in biographies and in their and re-immersing myself in their work, and particularly in reading their letters. That's as close. I mean, they were all very calculating about how they appeared in public, so they were never free of self-consciousness entirely, but there are moments in their letters when they really do shine through, and certain characteristic habits of thought and language begin to show themselves. And it was like hunting some elusive prey, and you'd see them there for a minute, and then I'd grab them. And that was, there is maybe a kind of hubris in trying to assume the personae of these writers, but I felt I had a license to do it, if for no other reason than that they themselves were so assiduous in cultivating kind of fictional personae of their own. I mean, each of these three writers, Ayn Rand, Robert Frost, and Ernest Hemingway, were very careful to project a certain image of themselves into the world, and they tended that image very carefully.
Ayn Rand is one of the visiting writers who comes to the school in your novel, Old School, and she gives some advice. Why did you choose her? Were you ever under her spell as a young man?
I was indeed. I confess that I was. I read Ayn Rand when I was about 17, late 16. And I was under her spell for, I'm afraid, longer than my narrator in the book, for about a year. And I cringe when I recall my arrogance at the time, an arrogance which somehow her work seemed to encourage, not only in me, but in my contemporaries who read it. I mean, we all imagined ourselves this steely-eyed Howard Roark. She has a very seductive message for the young, or at least I think the young are particularly vulnerable to it. She gives very simple answers to very complex questions.
Would you read some of the advice that you have Ayn Rand giving the students?
You bet. Ayn Rand in this passage here is meeting with a group of boys from the school, and they're here to hear her wisdom, and here is some of it. Boys, let me tell you what your value does not derive from. It does not derive from the self-sacrifice demanded by some party or state or from the church of some ludicrous god. It does not proceed from the people. In exchange for your reason and your freedom, they may give you a certificate of virtue, even some power, but this is worthless. It is less than worthless. It is bondage. When your power comes from others, on approval, you are their slave. Never sacrifice yourselves. Never. Whoever urges you to self-sacrifice is worse than a common murderer who at least cuts your throat himself without persuading you to do it. You must revere yourselves. To revere yourself is to live truly. And as I know only too well, to live truly is to live at war. Yes, at war, with the people and the party and the guilt-peddling Jesus industry.
Oh, it must be so heady to hear that when you're a kid.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Oh, complete freedom, all constraints. And
you're a hero, of course, for doing it.
You're a hero for doing it. The argument here underlying all this is you really don't owe anybody anything. Mm-hmm. And she herself used to say that she had never been helped by anyone in her life, that she had done everything herself. But when you read biographies of her, as I did, you see that, in fact, she was helped along in her life at many important points, as we all are. We all survive on the mercy of others and the kindness of others. And this was something that she could not recognize in her scheme of things. She, for example, claimed that she had never made a mistake in her life. She really was extraordinary. She wasn't stupid, but she had an extremely radically narrow vision of things, and it did not allow for the nuances and the complications of human relations and for the systems of debt and obligation that we naturally incur as we go through life and have some responsibility to return to others. That formed no part of her vision.
My guest is Tobias Wolff. His new novel is called Old School. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air.